This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
But faced with adverse legislation based on false assumptions that defy the logic of how Facebook works, and which, if passed, will create globally unprecedented forms of financial liability for news links and content, we feel it is important to be transparent about the possibility that we may be forced to consider whether we continue to allow the sharing of news content on Facebook in Canada.
That was Kevin Chan. That is Global Policy Director and a frequent public voice on behalf of Facebook, appearing before the Heritage Committee on Bill C-18, the Online News Act. The comments, which had obvious echoes with a similar position the company took in Australia last year, attracted immediate attention and an angry rebuke from government MPs. They quickly accused the company of threatening Canadians with its announcement that it would consider stopping news sharing in Canada if the bill passes unamended. But are these threats a bluff, or, having just laid off 11,000 employees, an accurate reflection of where the company stands on the value of news on its platform given current economic realities? Axel Burns is a professor of communication and media studies at QUT Digital Media Research Center at the Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia, and he's also a chief investigator in the ARC Center of Excellence for Automated Decision-Making and Society. He's written about the Australian News Media Bargaining Code and the effects of the Facebook news sharing block that took place in 2021. He joins me on the podcast to discuss the Australian experience in an effort to answer the question of whether Facebook is bluffing or if the practice of news sharing in Canada on the platform might be placed at risk if Bill C-18 should become law. Axel, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you've taken the time out of what I know is a busy schedule, including a lot of travel, to come on. As you know, Canada finds itself in the midst of a political and policy battle that I think will sound familiar to you and to many others in Australia, namely the prospect of requiring internet platforms, particularly Facebook and Google, to compensate news outlets for the use of their content. And while there's quite a lot of debate, even within that sentence, you know, what constitutes use? The commonality here is that there's been unsurprising opposition from the internet companies and a great deal of support also, I guess, unsurprisingly, from the large media companies in Canada. Now, I thought it'd be great to bring you on the podcast to talk a bit more about what happened in Australia and what Canada might learn from that, in part because Facebook's recent position in Canada is that if the government goes through with the bill in its current form, it says it may be forced to stop sharing of news, which is something that it did in Australia as well. And some perceive all of that to be a big bluff, that they wouldn't actually go through with that. So I wanted to learn more about the experience that Australia had, because they went through pretty much the same thing. Why don't we start with the news media bargaining code that Australia created? Can you talk a bit about the Australian system and how it came to fruition?
Absolutely. I think it was very much driven by the same sort of ideas that the Canadian initiative is driven by as well. Essentially, the Australian government sought to funnel off, if you like, some of the funding, some of the money that the revenue that the platforms are making from the display, the sharing, the circulation of news on platforms like Facebook and others, and it sort of funneled that money, some of that advertising money, particularly to the producers of that news content. And essentially, the news media bargaining code was intended to compel the platforms to enter into negotiation with news media, to bargain, as the name says, with news media, to arrange for some sort of payment, essentially, for the circulation of this news content on their platforms.
I want to get into sort of the response of Facebook and some of the other issues, but curious, the debate in Canada has focused on a bunch of issues, some of which include, you know, the beneficiaries of this. I know in Australia, obviously, the Murdoch Empire is very powerful. In Canada, much of the talk has been about the beneficiaries being broadcasters, as well as the handful of very large media outlets. Did you have similar kinds of discussions? For example, some of the concerns been that some of the smaller outlets might not be beneficiaries as part of this system, and concerns as well about the transparency of the whole system. Did you see some of those same kinds of debates playing out in Australia?
Very much so, because while I've given you sort of the official version of why this news media bargaining code was meant to be introduced, in many ways, really, ultimately, the question of who this would benefit, of course, is very much at the back of all of this as well. And as you say, Australia is very much dominated by Murdoch media still, particularly when it comes to legacy media like newspapers. Murdoch media are often the only newspapers in town. Of course, it's particularly those sorts of legacy media as well who've been doing it quite tough in recent years. So to an extent, this was also seen by some commentators as a way to prop up traditional media empires in Australia, both in print and broadcast. Thereby ultimately also supporting maybe some of the friends in the media that the then government had. And the concern was that this would not benefit, for instance, our public service broadcasters, ABC and SBS, that it wouldn't really do anything for newer entrants into the market, born digital outlets, that even collectively wouldn't have the bargaining power that these large media companies do. And in Australia, and I think this probably applies to Canada as well, there was also a concern that rural and regional media would also be somewhat left out from this compared to the large big city media companies.
Yeah, no, we're seeing much the same debate. During our hearings before the House of Commons, we've had some of the very small media outlets from provinces like Saskatchewan and Alberta say that upwards of 50, 60, even 70% of their members would not be eligible under the way the bill is currently constructed. And there's the prospect the government may seek to respond to some of those concerns. So that we've seen those kinds of concerns. It's interesting that those parallels exist. Let's turn to the response from the internet platforms, which I suspect may have been somewhat similar as well. Mm-hmm. Now, as the bill was being developed in Australia, Facebook famously responded in Australia by saying that if news sharing went ahead in the form that was being discussed, it might be forced to stop that news sharing. You know, what was basically its argument or rationale behind taking that position?
Yeah, and maybe to give you a bit of a timeline for this as well. So the bill, the draft, I guess, was really starting to be discussed in the second half of 2020. And from about August, September onwards, basically both Facebook and Google as well were making noises about what that would mean. Google was showing up a few, pop-ups essentially on its site saying, the way that Australians use Google is at risk. Your search experience will be hurt by the new regulation. But in some ways kind of rode the coattails of Facebook, which responded a lot more forcefully and a lot more explicitly by basically saying, if this draft code becomes law, and I'm quoting from their release, we will reluctantly stop allowing publishers and people in Australia from sharing local and international news on Facebook and Instagram. So a very clear threat, essentially, to say, well, you know, if this happens, then we just can't carry news on this platform anymore. Essentially saying, well, in some ways we support and we share the support for news organizations, but this isn't the way to do it. This is overreach. This is trying to regulate tech companies and the way that they do business with publishers. So that's the kind of rhetoric that they rolled out. And the writing was very clearly on the wall. They were not in any way being not hiding, I guess, what they were, what they said they would do. They were very explicitly spelling out what the consequences of this law would be.
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, it sounds like the Facebook put out a blog post here in Canada. It sounds like they were pretty similar. Although there's a sense, at least so far, that some of the other stakeholders in the government isn't taking it all that seriously. They're certainly taking the position seriously, in which they've been very anxious to paint Facebook as being evil for taking this position. But there's sort of this underlying sense that somehow they wouldn't really go through with it. I'm curious, how did the Australian government respond at first? Did they take this seriously and think that this was a real possibility?
No, I think that there was a sense that, yes, this is probably just a bluff in Australia as well. For instance, the ACCC, the Australian Consumer and Competition Commission, which was really very deeply involved in developing this this law and was the organization, the government organization that released, for instance, initial concept papers and draft legislation for comment as well. Its chairman, Rod Sims, at the time responded by essentially pointing to the amount of news that circulates on Facebook. He was quoting, for instance, the Digital News Report, which is this annual global study of digital news platforms and the use of news on digital platforms, that said in 2020 that 39% of Australians used Facebook for general news, 49% used Facebook for news about COVID-19, which of course was very much in full swing at that point as well. So in some ways, the government and its organizations essentially said, well, they wouldn't do this because news is so widespread on Facebook. So many Australians rely on news, on Facebook for their news. So it's very unlikely that Facebook would deprive them of this really critical use. But at the same time, Facebook then also came out and responded and said, well, yes, but that's assuming that news is actually a really important aspect on Facebook. It might be important for Australians, but it's not actually that important for Facebook. Facebook responded and said news represents a fraction of what people see in their newsfeed. It's not a significant source of revenue for us. That's their literal words. In some ways, this was kind of, you know, responding to the government by saying, well, yes, we know lots of Australians get their news from Facebook, but it's still not a very big use. There's lots of other things that Australians do on Facebook as well, and we will just concentrate on those other things. Australian news users will just have to live with that.
Yeah, no, that's the parallels here are very obvious, right down to, quite frankly, Rod Sims being very vocal in Canada about the Australian system and why Canada should adopt it. He's done op-eds. He's appeared before a Canadian committee that's been examining this issue. So there's been clear parallels there. And Facebook's claims about the importance of news on the platform are similar. They now say it's down to 3% of the content is news content in terms of what's actually, of its actual use, and so is relatively immaterial from a revenue perspective. One of the reasons I was so anxious to have you on is that you actually did research on what happened once they did start blocking news for a period of time. Can you start by talking a bit about how they went ahead and did that, how broad or overbroad was the blocking, and how effective was their attempt to block news sharing on their platform?
Yeah, absolutely. So this happened ultimately as the bill was being introduced into Parliament for to be voted on in February 2021. On the 18th of February 21. Essentially, from early in the morning, Facebook implemented this what ultimately was a total ban on news in Australia. So that meant that the Australian news outlets themselves could no longer post any content on their Facebook pages. And in fact, their Facebook pages were basically empty of content. Anything that already was there was no longer accessible. They themselves couldn't post content. Any other Australian news user could not post content either. So links to Australian news sites, in fact, links to international news sites as well. So it wasn't just limited in that sense to Australia. So anyone who wanted to share, a link to a news site would get a pop-up saying this post cannot be shared at this point. Anyone trying to access news from any source on Facebook would get a pop-up saying this content cannot be accessed right now. But it went actually well beyond that. So in addition to legitimate, genuine news outlets that suddenly had no content on their pages and whose content could not be shared. This also went to other kind of news-like content, for instance, the Australian Bureau of Meteorology, which in itself isn't a news outlet, obviously, but has content that is ultimately newsworthy. Its page was empty as well, and even the pages of the various state and federal health departments, which of course, again, in the middle of the COVID pandemic, were providing daily updates on cases and on changes to regulations, on where to find vaccines and testing centers and so on. Their content disappeared as well, which was particularly problematic, of course, at that time. And it went really all the way down even to things like, cooking magazines and other forms of, media, but not news content as such. So a lot of that also disappeared. In a handful of cases, those bans were rescinded over the following days because obviously there was a lot of negative publicity, not just about the news media ban overall, but about the overreach that this showed as well. But ultimately, it really meant that there was a complete and total news blackout on Facebook in Australia from the 18th of February. And we actually, with the data that we as researchers have access to, which comes ironically from Facebook's own data service, CrowdTangle, we were able to see that the posting of links to news content really went down to almost zero. It took a little while for that to be fully implemented. People were at first finding some ways to circumvent this by posting shortened links, bit.ly links and so on, by posting indirect links and so on to news content, but Facebook gradually cracked down on that as well. And really, more importantly, we could see the effects of the news blackout, the news ban, by looking at engagement as well. So even if people were still able to somehow circumvent the ban by using a chain of link shorteners that would make it difficult for Facebook to identify that this was news content at the time of posting, eventually it would wisen up to this, and there was just a total lack of engagement by ordinary users with that content that we saw during this time. So it was really a very comprehensive news ban on Facebook, which lasted for, really over a week. It lasted to the 26th of February, at which point then finally this was switched on again. And that really was an obvious demonstration of Facebook's ability to take the nuclear option, if you like, to so comprehensively remove all of this news content from its platform. And I think a clear warning sign probably for other countries that are attempting to implement something similar.
Okay, so it worked. Did based on your research, did people move elsewhere? So did other social media companies, for example, see an uptake in the sharing of news? Were there alternatives, in a sense, to Facebook for some of this kind of sharing of news content?
It's really difficult to say, to be honest, because we really lack comprehensive data on other platforms as well as on general use of news sites directly. Of course, people could still go to the news sites directly if they could remember what the URLs were, but we don't have public data on these kinds of patterns in full. However, I'd also really note, I guess, that a lot of people, of course, Facebook is right in many ways. A lot of people simply aren't on Facebook for the news. So many Facebook users, and we know this from years of research, are, if anything, encountering news serendipitously on the platform because someone in their network will share a link that ultimately is interesting that they might click on, but they're not actively seeking out the news. They're just seeing it because someone else shared it into their feeds. So those much more casual news users who are not actively searching, who are not necessarily going to the websites of news outlets themselves, first may have not even noticed the absence of news in their feed because a lot of other stuff was still there, and then may also not very actively try to compensate for that lack of news in their feed. So I think for a lot of people, who are really ordinary Facebook users and not news junkies in that sense, they might have just continued on their way on Facebook in really quite a normal way, and may not really have noticed the absence of news in that sense. In fact, we did look at the overall volume of engagement to the extent that we could see it on Facebook, which is really engagement with Australian-based Facebook pages on any topic. From that, you really couldn't see any kind of positive or negative impact of the news ban at all. Essentially, the total volume of engagement with what we could identify as clearly Australian pages on Facebook really continued at very much normal levels. And the drop down in engagement with news wasn't even really visible in those figures either, because again, Facebook is actually right that people are not predominantly on the platform for news. So if news disappears, the vast majority of people will simply continue to use Facebook as they do. And that absence of news may not really register all that much either.
No, Kyle, thanks for that. It's a terrific answer. And I want to drill down just a bit further on where you left off. Facebook's position in Canada has been that news may be important to the news organizations in terms of its appearance on Facebook. But from Facebook's perspective, it's a very small part of the user experience. And so isn't all that important. And so your research actually provided the opportunity to test that theory. Right? Mm-hmm. Essentially taking a look at what was the engagement like once news was removed. And I take it you found that, in fact, Facebook is pretty accurate in its position that the needle didn't move all that much in terms of user engagement, even though, as you've said, they were successful in basically removing news almost entirely from the platform.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, with the limitation, of course, that really what we can see on Facebook is in itself very tightly circumscribed by what data is available from Facebook, and that's not a huge deal. What we can see is what's provided via CrowdTangle, Facebook's own data platform, and within that you can search for pages and only pages, not anything that happens around personal profiles or groups or anything else that's also not fully publicly visible. But within that, at least, we could look at Australian Facebook pages. And we saw that, you know, on an average day, in an average hour, there may be, you know, about about 2,000 posts or so during the daytime on Australian Facebook pages per hour. That continued very much without any kind of impact from the news ban itself. In terms of interactions, so your comments and reactions and shares and so on Facebook, you might have maybe a half a million or so interactions on average per hour with that content on Australian Facebook pages. And again, that volume didn't change in any significant way when news content was removed. So really, the majority of posting and interactions on Australian Facebook pages, at least, are about things other than news. Now, what we don't know is how much news sharing there is going on around people's personal profiles and how the absence of news might have affected that. So that would assume, for instance, that news content is more widely shared than other types of content are on Facebook around personal profiles. We simply don't know that because Facebook does not provide data on this via CrowdTangle or any other source. That's the one limitation. But from all that we could observe, certainly, this was a really interesting natural experiment in a sense. What Facebook would look like and what the activity on Facebook would be when there's no news, at least from the spaces that we could observe, there simply wasn't a difference. So yes, as you're saying, news on Facebook is important to the publishers, and a lot of Australians do get their news from Facebook as well, but news on Facebook is not important to Facebook as a component of everything else that's going on. And ultimately, Australians and other Facebook users are doing a lot of things that aren't news on Facebook as well. And that's the vast majority of the activity that happens on Facebook. It's just not news related.
Now, in the aftermath of all this, both sides seem to claim victory. What was your take after Facebook put the news back up and, you know, things went as normal? The legislation obviously ultimately passes. Did Facebook win in some way, or did the government win? What was your view of that?
Yes, in some ways it's a little bit difficult to really conclude on this fully. The government, of course, could point to the fact that ultimately news content was restored to Facebook, so it could say that we've successfully negotiated with Facebook and have essentially won this argument because news is now back. But at the same time, that's only after Facebook extracted some really significant concessions from the government. So the way that the News Media Bargaining Code would work is that platforms are designated under the code, which means that that's actually the designation compels them to enter into negotiations with the various media outlets to work out how to shift some of the revenue to these outlets. Now the concession that Facebook has extracted is that Facebook will not be designated under the code, but will instead enter into voluntary negotiations with the news platform. So it is, at this point, as of now, exempt from the News Media Bargaining Code. And that obviously is a very significant win for it as well. The government still essentially doesn't have any power over it until some future government decides that actually Facebook should be designated under the code, and then we're probably back to square one where Facebook will threaten or actively go through with removing news content from its platform again. So in that sense, Facebook certainly won by making sure it isn't actually covered by the law at this point. Facebook has now also entered into negotiations with a selection of news publishers and has as a result of those negotiations, been paying some amount of funding back to the news publishers. It's not entirely clear how much and under what conditions, because partly also, again, as a result of not being designated under the code, these negotiations now happen bilaterally between Facebook and the publishers. The results don't need to be published. There's not even any requirement that the money that the publishers are now getting from Facebook is invested back into journalism, which was, of course, the point of the News Media Bargaining Code. So from that perspective, Facebook itself can strike some deals with some publishers and say it's abiding by the code, and will have to pay, for it relatively small amounts of money to these publishers, but without any kind of public scrutiny or government scrutiny on those deals. And in that sense, you could even say that the publishers are possibly winners as well, at least the larger commercial publishers, because they get a little bit of additional revenue from this, but they're also not forced to reinvest that into journalism. So that can also simply go to the company bottom line, or it can be paid out to investors. So that level of obscurity, that level of that lack of public scrutiny also benefits them, because they're not forced to make additional investments in journalism. So this is very much a gentleman's agreement in a sense between all three sides that to some extent benefits all of them, but except obviously the public and except the smaller publishers and public broadcasters who are not at this point gaining any benefit from these negotiations.
That's a fantastic summary of where things are at. There are real echoes with the debate in Canada, where there's been talk about transparency, and while the deals that might be established outside of the mandated system have to be reported to the regulator, the actual numbers will not be made public to anyone. And the same kinds of concerns about some of the large media organizations, perhaps the platforms, depending on what those deals look like, and the government for saying that they did something, come away winners. But there's a big concern that some of the smaller players, the digital first type platforms in particular, mm-hmm. may ultimately end up losers as part of the system, or at least for the most part on the outside looking in.
Yeah, and you know, the News Media Bargaining Code to some extent was sold by the government as shoring up public interest journalism, generating innovation in journalism. Really, it's not clear that any of that will result from these deals, because there's just no necessity. There's no automatism by which the funding that the companies now do receive from Facebook actually flows to these sorts of ends. That I think is one of the big tragedies almost in this, that the one core thing that you know, was supposedly going to happen from all of this just isn't eventuating. I mean, in fairness, I do need to say some publishers have invested in the funding that they've received in a handful of additional journalists on particular key areas. But of course, that's very much up to the discretion of each of these publishing houses. And it certainly not happened across the board that this really in some ways improves the quality of journalism or adds journalists on particular news beats that have been underserved.
You know, Axel, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. There's throughout the debate on the Canadian bill, Australia has been invoked so frequently, oftentimes as a model of what Canada is trying to do and a model that should be followed. And I think, you know, you've provided certainly some of the benefits that may have come, but also I think some warning signals, both about about where the ultimate beneficiaries are. The word journalism scarcely appears in our bill at all, as well as whether or not the kind of concerns that have been raised by the platforms themselves might actually come to fruition. So thank you so much for taking the time to join me on the podcast.
Yeah, no worries. And I'm going to be looking at the Canadian case with great interest, of course, as well, to see if it plays out the same way as it has in Australia.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod. Or Michael Geist @mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.